Hey everyone, welcome back to the Physician Syndicate podcast. I'm your host, Ronak.
And I'm your host, Greg, up in the Adirondacks.
Fantastic. So I think there's a lot of news going on right now in the financial markets that we want to touch on. The two topics are everything going on with First Republic Bank, and the second is everything going on with interest rates. So this is a very busy week. So depending on when we actually publish this episode, a little bit of it might be outdated, but we'll try to keep things pretty high level for what's going on in the macro world. Just a lot of interesting things. So over this past weekend, we saw JP Morgan basically take over First Republic Bank. First Republic Bank went into receivership from the FDIC, and then Jamie Dimon and JP Morgan came and take it over. So basically what this means is that First Republic Bank basically just failed. So the same way that Silicon Valley Bank did. So this is two US top 20 banks that have failed in the last 3 months. I think there still is a relatively a lot of calm in the market, but they say that history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And if we rewind back to 2008 for a second, the first major domino to drop was actually Bear Stearns, the fourth largest investment bank in the country, getting taken over by who else than Jamie Dimon and JP Morgan. So this is just like really interesting where we're at. We're also seeing a whole bunch of other regional banks. Their stocks are dropping on average around 7 to 8% today. We're recording this on Tuesday, May 2nd. So we'll see how the rest of the week turns out. But there's a big question right now. Is there any real reason to keep your money at a regional bank right now? It's so easy to click a few buttons on your mobile app and move your money from a regional bank over to a Bank of America or a Citibank or something like that. Greg, my first question for you is, if you are a startup running a small business or even an individual, a physician just managing your own personal finances, is there any significant reason not to go with one of the big, huge money center banks?
Now it doesn't seem like it. You know, it's an interesting story. And it's also interesting that JP Morgan didn't buy Silicon Valley Bank, in my mind, if they're going to go after First Republic. Yeah, from like a personal standpoint, it makes me think that going with a larger bank that is less likely to be prone to failure like this, it's a no-brainer. But again, this is also the thinking that probably leads to these runs on the bank and the concern for these regional banks, which, you know, now that First Republic's gone down. When Silicon Valley stuff was happening, it also seemed like First Republic was also in the news at the same time because basically the same, I think, over-leveraged point that Silicon Valley Bank was. And yeah, I mean, for startups, I think most at this point have likely figured out that, hey, I should be having, if I have $5 million in the bank and only $250,000, that's FDIC insured, I need to spread that amongst multiple accounts. And then also, yeah, going with a larger bank makes a lot of sense. The other interesting thing that I saw somebody's Twitter post about the JP Morgan takeover of First Republic was, oh, I guess that's how you become a JP Morgan client as a startup, because I think it's a lot harder, which is one of the reasons that startups go with these banks, just because they all know startups very well. They've worked with them a lot in the past. Going with a larger bank is not necessarily the easiest thing, especially when you have to potentially accept 10, 20 wires at a time, send a bunch of wires. Like, startups have very niche needs that some of the larger banks don't necessarily do a good job of taking care of. And now you have these people that are First Republic customers that are now going to JP Morgan. They're like, oh yeah, this is how you get into JP Morgan, is your bank fails and then they get bought by them. But from a personal standpoint, yeah, like, what's the point of keeping money in a bank that has any concern in going under? Like, I don't really want to be involved with any of that. I know probably you don't either, Ronak. Yeah, from the startup perspective, from the personal perspective, the rich keep getting richer. If all of these deposits start flowing into the top four banks, then, you know, they're just going to get stronger and stronger, which then also goes into the play of, you might as well have your capital in the strongest potential location.
Yeah. So, Greg, I think there are two issues there. So one, as these startups move their finances over to a place like a JP Morgan, I don't think that they're going to get the same lending terms and options that they had with First Republic Bank. So you were saying that it was much more difficult for startups to work with the JP Morgan in the past, which is why they went to a First Republic Bank. But I don't think that just because JP Morgan takes over a bunch of clients from First Republic Bank, all of a sudden they're going to loosen their standards for lending to startups. So I actually look at this as thinking to myself that, like, this could lead to a credit crunch for startups that are going to be looking to put together some capital over the next 6, 12, 18 months, especially if more and more regional banks start to go down and just get taken over. So I would be a little bit cautious from that standpoint. The other side of it is most countries around the world, they only have a very small handful of banks. The US is one of the few countries across the world where there are all these regional banks and credit unions and all sorts of different things. And if we are moving towards a world where you only have a single digit of banks that's managing the funds for the entire country, that puts us in a pretty bad state, right? Like, one of the cool things about America is that there has been so much innovation and risk-taking and just trying to develop new ideas and like having the financing to go after that. But if everything is so algorithmically driven from these big banks where there aren't the relationships saying that, like, you know what, I trust you as an entrepreneur, let me give you a loan and just see what you can do for the rest of the community, I do worry that the regional banking infrastructure has been one of the lifebloods for what's made the American dream.
Do you think we should bail out these banks?
Yeah, because I do think that there is a bigger problem that if depositors lose their money, then we have a much, much bigger crisis on our hands. Your entire life savings is in a small bank. It all disappears. You're now talking about riots on the street.
But do you think, so that's backing the depositors, but what about the banks themselves?
The banking themselves, no. If you're a stockholder of a bank, you got to go through the finances. You got to make your own decision on, is this bank going to survive? Are they managing their operations correctly or incorrectly? Yeah, the shareholders, the employees, the managers of the bank, they should not be bailed out, in my opinion.
Yeah, so I think the big thing for me in terms of like, where do you go in the future now is I wonder if these runs on the bank changes the investing pattern of these regional banks and they reconsider how they allocate depositor money, right? If you're going to be leveraged to the point that, you know, if people start pulling their money out of their accounts, that you're no longer solvent, it's like there has to be some kind of change within the system to say, okay, we're not going to over leverage ourselves and put ourselves at risk, because if we do, especially today, we might be screwed and the bank may not exist in what has been 2 months since Silicon Valley Bank exploded and now another one has. So I think that's the other thing is like, maybe you think about a different way that you make money as a bank, given that most people, when they put money into a bank account, whether it's a credit union or Wells Fargo or Schwab, doesn't think, oh, this money is going to go out to 100 different investments that this bank is going to go make money on. But then you think, what if they lose, right? What if they lose all of those bets and now my money's at risk? I don't think most people think about that. I think they do now, or at least they should. But is there a bank that you can be like, hey, you guys don't actually do anything with this money. You actually just hold it. But again, then it's like, that bank's not going to make a lot of money. So it's like a weird situation where you, as the person putting your money in, want your money to be safe, but you also want your bank to exist, which means they're going to need to make money somehow off of you. But then you also don't want them to make too much money and put themselves too much at risk that their bank fails. So I feel like it's an interesting balancing act that banks, especially regional banks, are now going to have to figure out.
Yeah. So Greg, we just released an episode with an interview with the CEO of a company called CrowdHealth. And we did touch on Bitcoin for a little bit in that conversation. I just want to be clear, I'm not trying to push cryptocurrency to anybody. I'm very hesitant about this entire space. But the idea behind hard money and cryptocurrency, you know, specifically Bitcoin or even gold, is exactly what you were talking about there, Greg, right? That like, how do you find a bank where you give it your paycheck and it just keeps that money? It doesn't lend it out over and over again, making more and more risky investments to the point where the bank could fail. Theoretically, that's what Bitcoin is trying to be, right? There's only ever going to be 21 million Bitcoins in the world. So if you go buy one Bitcoin, put it in your own personal wallet, it's like a bank account that's just not doing anything with it. And it's just sitting there. So it'd be really interesting to see, like, over the next few years, does the idea of hard money come back into the lexicon? I think there's a lot of problems with going with hard money. The US economy has obviously done fantastic since 1971, where the US dollar came off of the gold standard. I do think that this is just a balancing act. Like, the banking system is a little bit fragile. There are questions about the US dollar's maintaining its status as a reserve currency of the world. I'm sure China and India and Brazil, Russia, and all these other countries want to see a change in the US dollar retaining its value and how that could impact the banking system. I think that there is a lot to be worried here. I don't want to cause any like fear or panic or anything like that. We've seen through history that there are moments of big economic change. And if you rewind back to 2008 again, yes, that was a big crisis that was really bad, but things largely stayed the same, right? You still use the same dollars. Bank of America is still around. You didn't have a big global shift. I hope that we're not on another big global shift anytime soon and things get resolved, but I think it's important just to pay attention to what's going on with all of this.
Are there any investments or places that you can actually store your money outside of crypto where they're not going to use your money for something else, right? To go purchase mortgages from somebody or whatever it is. Are there any instances where you as a consumer can put your money into something and say, it's not going to be used for something else? Like savings accounts, checking accounts, do they use that capital?
Yeah,
I'm assuming they do.
That's a really good question. And the answer is, yeah, all these banks use all your checking account and savings accounts. If you think about Wells Fargo, right, for your checking account, they probably pay you like 0.02%. But then if you go get a mortgage from them, you probably are going to be paying 7%, right? So that's how Wells Fargo makes its money. You are going to have things if you go buy, let's say, Coca-Cola stock and you're leaving in your Charles Schwab account or your Vanguard account or whatever it is, right? They're going to have a much more difficult time taking out loans against that. But you still are going to have issues, right? Like whenever somebody is short selling a stock, they're borrowing it, and that still is the same issue. The classic example has just been gold, which is just like a very difficult way for one to store their own money. You could store cash $100 bills under your mattress if you really wanted to, but I think—
Or you could buy real estate.
You could buy real estate, yeah. Or artwork. There's a reason why all these Van Gogh paintings or even like Ferrari cars and Rolex watches maintain their value over time. They're not loaned out. Yeah, they do appreciate it. I think they do have the risk of getting damaged. Same thing with a real estate.
Or stolen.
You can get insurance on these things, but you know, that is something to think about.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting question, right? Okay, you are a new physician. You're making 10 times what you're making as a resident, whatever it is. It's like, yeah, where do you put that money? You don't want to just leave it in savings account doing nothing for you. You don't want to put it in a checking account doing nothing for you. But then it's like if you go to your regional bank, are you worried that it might go under and it might be difficult to get your cash out of there? Maybe. Yeah, it's an interesting dilemma. It's like, where do you put that capital now that you have it without kind of concern that it's going to disappear overnight? That was my concern with crypto too. It's like it came crashing down. It's like, there it goes. Even though Bitcoin, you can't create more Bitcoin, but it can go down in value as people sell. Yeah, that's the reason that you have diversification within a portfolio is you want to limit your risk by having multiple asset categories.
I think it is also important to note that I think there's been around 75 bank failures in the last 100 years for this country. And I think something like 74 of them, no depositor lost even a one penny, right? First Republic Bank, Silicon Valley Bank, all those depositors were made whole. And I just don't really see a future other than we just have, let's say, 10 mega banks in this country. Sure, everybody maintains like whatever deposits they make, but the whole relationship-based lending and financing programs basically disappear. Greg, the other topic that a lot of people are talking about right now is interest rates. So over the next couple of days, the Federal Reserve is going to make a decision. The expectation is that they're going to raise by about a quarter point and then probably just leave it there, if not start cutting towards the back half of this year. This is obviously going to have repercussions on everything from the real estate market to how startups are valued to the stock market in general. I think it's very difficult to predict how interest rates are going to change and evolve over time. We do have the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting coming up this weekend, and I'm sure Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger are going to be asked all about interest rates. There, I can only guess that their answers are going to be like, nobody can predict this stuff, but inflation is probably going to be more sticky than people expect. It wouldn't shock me personally if we end up having interest rates that are reaching like 7-8% over the next couple of years. Greg, any thoughts on like how one might want to position their portfolio given the unpredictability of interest rates?
I don't know what other people should do. One of the things that I'm doing though, which again, this is not financial advice, but given the uncertainty with interest rates and rising interest rates and like, where do you put your capital? One of the things that I did was put a fairly significant chunk within JEPI. So that's the one we've talked about, I think once, at least on the podcast. It might not outperform the S&P in a good year, but in a down year or a flat year, getting 69% in distributions and dividends is pretty nice, because then you're at least staying above inflation. So that's what I'm doing to diversify my portfolio, is like just figuring out where can I put capital that is at least going to make something, hopefully, given market conditions and concerns for recession, depression, whatever it is that we eventually get into, are things that hopefully can create cash flow for us. And so the other thing that we do is a fair amount of real estate investing. So I'm actually recording up in the Adirondacks right now, getting a second Airbnb property up and running, which we got a relatively good mortgage rate on, which I'm sure now if things are going to keep going up in terms of interest rates, will be a really good mortgage rate when you look at it in the future. But for us, it's how do you take capital that you have and figure out a way to make more capital from it, right? How do you make little baby monies? And so for us, it was really diversifying our brokerage account a little bit to something that's going to make some kind of yield that maybe it will do better than the S&P this year. But again, in a good year, the S&P will destroy it. And then also just figuring out other ways to get cash flow coming from different things. And one of those other things that we do is real estate. Those are our big buckets. Again, we've seen pretty good results so far with the first Airbnb property, even though there's a lot of doom and gloom out there with Airbnb. I can't remember what the Twitter handle or the Twitter thread was, but a lot of people were calling for doom and gloom with Airbnb bookings being down. We've seen it pretty steady. And so hopefully it stays that way and we can keep adding properties as we go because they cash flow nicely.
Yeah, Greg. So, well, actually for our listeners, if anybody wants us to go into further detail on what the S&P 500 is, what JEPI is, how to think about interest rates for bank accounts, definitely let us know. We're more than happy to do a personal finance 101 episode at some point. But I think it's really interesting that if interest rates do stay very high like this, most physicians probably are not thinking about what interest rates are doing on a day-to-day basis. And when you look at salary evolution over one's career, it typically does not keep up with inflation, right? So physicians, obviously, they're doing very well. They're making very good compensation compared to the rest of the population in general. But I think it's important to remember that as your career progresses, you're going to get raises, promotions, whatever it is. So keep working hard. That's a good thing to do. But also think about your own investment portfolio, because when you really look over the course of a 30, 40 year lifetime, that rate of return that you can get in terms of investing your own money, it's going to have a huge impact of like when you're going to be able to retire, how comfortable you are going to be when you retire. So just pay attention to the finance world in general.
Yeah, we should do an episode, Ronak, on physician reimbursement too, because that's a whole interesting topic that we can go into where the government's basically setting the reimbursement rates for physicians. And typically those are reimbursement cuts, which means that you have inflation on top of being paid less for the things that you're doing. I think that would be a really interesting one to go into relatively in depth. I'll have to do a little research on that. The reimbursement cuts plus how inflation is destroying the economy.
Interesting.
Because that absolute value would be pretty high, potentially, depending on your specialty. Doing the same amount of work, getting paid less, and your money goes half as far.
Oh, that sucks. Oh, man. Yeah.
What about you? What are you doing with your portfolio in these uncertain economic times?
Yeah. So what am I doing with my portfolio? So we touched on this a little bit earlier that I'm a little bit less interested in income. Again, just trying to live a relatively simple life where I don't need too much money to live. But I do want to try getting as high of a net worth as possible because I'm human. So I am holding off on things like JEPI and covered call strategies in terms of the ETF. I am doubling down pretty hard on the S&P 500 ETF. My opinion is that we're going through the equivalent of the 1970s, where we're seeing up and downs in terms of inflation, and that's going to result in the equivalent of a 1980s, where you just see an absolute boom in equity prices. I am also keeping quite a bit of money in cash or cash equivalents, like T-bills. They're yielding like 4-5% right now, which isn't bad at all. But at the same time, I'm getting my shopping list ready. I do think that if we do see a little bit more of a financial earthquake, there's a lot of interesting companies that I do want to invest in, both startups and publicly traded companies. They're not at the valuations that I want to get in at today, but I want to be prepared for that moment. In 2008, at the bottom, if you invested in Netflix, one company, right? Oh my God, what kind of life-changing returns could you have gotten from that? I don't want to miss that this time.
Well, Ronak, let me ask you a question. So one of the things that I had been thinking about investing in, you had pretty large investments in, which I think you sold, which would be Meta. So when Meta stock tanked because of all the things that they're doing with Reality Labs and all of their AR, VR, whatever you want to call it, and I think their quarterly growth went down for the first time in years. And you had basically people dumping the stock. I think it got down to $90 a share. And then you had Mark Zuckerberg get, it seemed like mad, basically. He's like, how is my stock going down this low? We're going to cut 11,000 employees and we're going to get fit, as I think Brad Gerstner says. How do you feel about that investment? Should you have held it? Or should you have bought into it when it hit 90, given that you were a Facebook employee, Meta employee?
Yeah, great question. So again, I was a Meta employee, left well over 6 months ago, have no inside information on what's going on there today. So a couple things. So on a previous podcast episode, we talked about a pitch that Greg, you and I got from this founder that just did not have as big of a grand vision as we were hoping for. It sounded like he was trying to get like a 4X, 5X, and raising money with that kind of return is fun. You know, we're really trying to knock it out of the ballpark. The way that I think about my investing portfolio is that if I'm going to be investing in something relatively safe and secure, I want it in something that's very well diversified, like an S&P 500 index fund. If I'm going to be investing in an individual company, I want there to be that huge potential of getting at least a 10X, if not significantly more than that. And I'm sure we'll talk about this on a future episode, but one of my biggest personal positions is in SpaceX, where I do think that there is a pathway towards another 10X from here in the next 10 years.
So is that your baseline then, a 10X in 10 years?
That's my baseline for breaking away from the S&P 500.
Interesting. So there's probably no public companies that you would consider investing in.
Probably not. There's a couple companies, I would say. One of them that I'm digging into a little bit more and more on the side is actually a company called Rocket Lab. They're probably the Lyft to Uber SpaceX. They're a company based out of New Zealand. They've reached orbit about a dozen times, which is a very difficult feat. They have a pretty ambitious roadmap, but maybe we'll get deeper into that into another episode. There's a small handful of other companies too that I'm looking at. But in general, it's a high bar for me to invest in a public company.
Yeah, that'd be an interesting thing to go back and look at from 2013 until now. Are there any public companies that have 10X'd since then?
Maybe they had
in 2021.
Absolutely. So when I first joined Facebook, it had just become a publicly traded company, and I think the stock price was around $22, $23. And this was 2013. And then at the peak, it was at around like $380.
That's the peak, though.
Right.
What about today?
Today, what's the share price? Something around like $240. So it's around a 10X.
I don't think it's that high, is it?
I think so.
That is 240. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So 10X, and it's been 11, 12 years, something like that. So that's in the ballpark.
That's pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's my point of keeping a little bit of cash liquid just in case we go through another 2008 like crash. What are those companies that you want to get into? Keeping a buying list ready so that when valuations really come down, you can make the right bets for the next decade.
Yeah. You probably don't want to put your money in McDonald's right now. They're trading at a pretty high revenue to share price right now, like a tech company. I think it's 9 times.
Wow.
which is crazy.
Would you ever short a company like that?
I don't know that much about shorting stocks, Ronak. Yeah. But that's actually not a bad idea. I guess the question is, are they going to continue trading at that level or not? I don't know. We might have to dig into McDonald's. McDonald's is an interesting one. We also need to do our second balance sheet episode. Maybe we'll do McDonald's given
how... Right, that's a good idea. We can talk about the liability side of it also. And McDonald's is cool because there's a real estate aspect that you're into. There's a stock aspect that I'm into. And there's a hamburger aspect that we both are into.
And French fries.
There we go.
All right, I think we'll cut it there. Thanks for listening to the Physician Syndicate podcast. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. As always, we'd like to remind you that the information and opinions expressed on this podcast are for educational and entertainment purposes only and should not be construed as financial or investment advice. Before making any investment decisions, we strongly recommend that you consult with your lawyer, tax professional, and financial planner. Keep in mind that investing in startups can be extremely risky, and there's a potential for loss of your entire investment. Remember to always conduct thorough research and consider your risk tolerance before making any financial decisions. Stay informed, and we look forward to having you join us on our next episode of the Physician Syndicate podcast.